Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Piancy. I am here, as usual, with my partner in crime, Bennett Tomlin. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Cass. How are you?
I'm doing good. We are joined by Nick Weaver, a lecturer at UC Berkeley and a researcher at the ICSI.
Yep.
It's a pleasure to have you on today, Nick. How are you?
Excellent. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on, and I look forward to today's topic. We're going to be talking about how Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, at least in their first iteration, I guess, were mainly used as a payments network for the dark web, for Silk Road, for stuff like that, kind of how that has stopped and how it really doesn't seem like there's much of a, like it's more of a speculative market more than anything else now, a gambling market.
Yes. So let's first talk about my background, though. I started looking at the cryptocurrency space back in 2012 because the research group I'm involved with focuses a lot on online criminality. And so, like, one of the things we were looking at is back in the day, you could break into computers and make money by mining Bitcoin before the graphics cards and then the ASICs ruined that for the bad guys. And, like, had colleagues, Sarah Michaeljohn in particular. She was the one who first came up with the Bitcoin tracing infrastructure and the heuristics to do that. The thing is most people who looked at the space in 2012, 2013, they looked at it, go, this is bogus, and ignore it. Or they become true believers. But I had a business model that allowed me to watch the space continuously, that I can watch the space, extract the comedy gold, which is amusing for me, and turn it into both academic papers and non-academic writing. And so I've been able to watch the space as a professional critic since basically the very beginning. I remember when Pirate at 40 first existed, came on the scene. And frankly, calling your pyramid scheme Celsius Network is just nowhere near as classy as calling it Pirate Savings and Trust.
They just don't make them like Trendon Shavers anymore, do they?
Nope. They don't make them like the pirate.
Nick, do you want to give our listeners just a little bit of an introduction into what Silk Road and some of the similar dark web marketplaces were like in 2012?
There was this guy, Ross Ulbricht, who suffered from what is best described as libertarian brain worms. And Ross Ulbricht observed a few things. The first was there were a new payment infrastructure on the field, and that was Bitcoin. And Bitcoin promised no intermediaries, and at the time, people thought that it was anonymous. During this time, there was a criminal alternative out there, Liberty Reserve, but this was a central service. You'd turn your dollars into Liberty Reserve dollars, and you could pass them around and turn them back. And this was actually really useful for the criminals, but it didn't entrance Ulbricht because it was a central service. And also, theoretically, not necessarily anonymous if the feds ever took over Liberty Reserve, which, well, they did. But if you just put up a web page to sell drugs, you would get caught. But Tor, the anonymity network, has this feature that allows you to do what are known as hidden services. They've rebranded them as onion services, but it's the same thing. You get a real long random name. It was at the time about 20 characters of random garbage. These days it's 50 characters of random garbage. And with the Tor browser, you could connect to those sites and your communication bounces around through six computers scattered all over the world, so the FBI can't discover where the server is. So innovation number one, use Bitcoin. Innovation number two, do it as a Tor hidden service so that the FBI can't find where the server is. But there was another innovation in Silk Road. The problem with being a good criminal is you need a reputation for being trustworthy. Now, this is a real problem when dealing with non-face-to-face transactions. How do I know, Bennett, that you're a trustworthy person? I don't. But you don't have to trust your drug dealer in Silk Road. You only have to trust Silk Road itself. So the idea with Silk Road is there were two other additions. Mandatory feedback E-Classic 1 to 5 star rating, and the market acted as escrow. So you trusted the market, not the dealers. So if you wanted to buy drugs on Silk Road, you log into Mt. Gox, buy some Bitcoin on Mt. Gox, transfer it to Silk Road. Once you're at Silk Road, you log in through the Tor browser, and you browse through all the drugs. Really, the market claimed to be a libertarian market for everything, but it was drugs, books about drugs, and so on. And so you arrange to buy your pot. You transfer the Bitcoin to the seller, except you don't. You transfer it in your account to the seller's account on Silk Road. But Silk Road is an escrow service. So your money is held by Silk Road until you get the drugs. Click on the review button saying, oh, this is some good primo grade A. Because let's face it, it was actually mostly pot that was being sold. And Silk Road then transfers the money to the seller. And so Silk Road was the intermediary on every drug deal because they were a active participant, but this meant that they mediated out the trust issues. The problem is you need to trust somebody. But with the dark market concept, you don't trust the dealers, you just trust the marketplace. Because if the dealer rips you off, you just tell the marketplace, the dealer ripped me off, and you get your money back.
That's really not, I mean, it's not a stupid idea.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I'm listening to you describe it, and I'm like, seems pretty reasonable.
It's certainly interesting, though, in the context of Bitcoin's history, right? And in the white paper where you have Satoshi talking about trying to eliminate credit card chargebacks and the like. And so instead of relying on censorship irreversible payments, you're holding the assets with this escrow in order to do these kind of transactions that at first glance seem well-suited to Bitcoin's censorship resistance, being purchasing drugs and other illicit items.
Yes, and it's quite obvious that once you start to look at real-world systems, being able to articulate who you trust makes the systems work. So since the time, people have kept trying to build truly decentralized dark markets like Open Bazaar and stuff like that. And those have just always failed because those you actually do have to trust the drug dealer or trust a random escrow service that's being gamed. And being able to do centralized trust makes systems so much more cheaper and workable. And that was one of the first lessons of Silk Road is you need to trust somebody in the criminal world, and a central marketplace is a much easier thing to trust. And the other thing is there's a lot of amusing stories from the time. One of the things that Silk Road did early on is they wanted to be a marketplace for everything. Now, everything has to include weapons, but this is where the marketplace ended up going up against libertarian ideals that your right to throw a punch stops at my nose. So what is the morality of selling weapons? You could either sell them, not sell them. But the problem is not selling them, you don't make the money. Because as the marketplace, Silk Road got a 10% cut. And yeah, the guns are a small fraction of the business, but you still don't want to leave money on the table. So what do you do if you're faced with this conundrum? Sell guns, don't sell guns.
I presume they just decided to sell them if there's money on the table. They didn't.
They split the baby with the bathwater. So instead, they created a spin-off site called The Armory, moved all the weapon sales onto The Armory, and so continued selling guns, just no longer under the Silk Road brand, until the armory collapsed because nobody wants to buy guns through Tor Hidden Services because the markets were very U.S.-centric. You're a person in the U.S. You want a gun. You're not a felon. You go in, you plunk down your money, and you get a gun. You are a felon. You go to a state that doesn't have private party purchases. You buy one off of Craigslist, meet at the local Walmart, do the exchange in cash, and then if your gun ever gets caught, the seller just goes, how was I supposed to know Jesse Pinkman was the meth king of Albuquerque? But if you want to really get in legal trouble, buy a gun and ship it through the mail. Because the Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, Explosives, and no, you're not allowed to have any fun things at all whatsoever, takes a really, really, really dim view on shipping guns through the mail, not to a licensed dealer. And so this was turning a business that's criminal but low risk into insanely criminal and insanely high risk and incredibly blinking on the radar of the feds. And so the gun sales actually ended up going away because when you split them off into your own site, you quickly realize it doesn't actually work for bad dudes.
Well, and that was actually one of the interesting things about the history of Silk Road to me is the things they forbade. Because at least on the surface, the Silk Road terms of service forbade child pornography, stolen credit cards, assassinations, which is humorous considering some things Ross would later try, and weapons of any type, which then caused these other black markets to pop up to try to offer the services that Silk Road refused to. So it's just this interesting dynamic during this period of Silk Road trying to create this more limited marketplace, which just then created nearly identical marketplaces with less rules.
My immediate question about this is, I know, obviously, we haven't gotten there yet, but obviously, I think anyone is pretty gonna find out pretty quickly that the Silk Road got shut down by the FBI. And that it came to a screeching halt. I know that there were briefly afterwards some attempts to do like a Silk Road 2.0 kind of thing. But I do find it kind of interesting that it doesn't seem like any of them have ever reached that level of popularity since then.
Well, they have, but they haven't gotten the public view because the problem is it's just not a very good business. But it's high profile enough that the feds take it seriously. So the marketplaces keep coming and going, but the feds go after them because, well, let's face it, it's fun. If you're an FBI agent dealing with, say, crime on the dark web, you can go after child exploitation, and the officers who do that are real heroes. But if you go after the drug dealers, it's a lot more fun. So they've basically gone after the market operators ever since. So like after Silk Road got busted, Silk Road 2 spun up. That was run by a guy called Blake Benthal. He was arrested within about 9 months, and he had enough sense to plead out and a rat on all his fellows. And as far as I know, I think he might even be out of jail soon. And so the markets are still around. They're just also a lot harder to find because what has happened is the gateways to the markets have been busted by the feds. So there was this site called Deep.Web, which acted as an index to the dark markets and reviews. And the problem is Deep.Web's monetization strategy was taking money in the form of Bitcoin from the darknet operators in order to basically advertise said dark drug dealers. And they got shut down by the feds and are now guests of the federal government. Reddit for a while had our darknet markets, and you could log in and read all the fun drama. But after Deep.Web got shut down, Reddit goes, yeah, this is a little too radioactive for us, and banned that group. And so now, basically, the only way to find the current state of the darknet markets is there's a Tor hidden service called Dread, which is basically Reddit as a Tor hidden service. But that's really a pretty annoying barrier to entry. But also, the thing is part of the reason why the darknet markets never got that big is Bitcoin sucks for payments. And we actually saw that right from the start at Silk Road. The problem is Bitcoin's price bounces up and down. And even if it bounced up and down randomly 1, 2% a day, this would be really annoying. But it bounces, what, 10% a day on a bad day? And so the marketplace had to do escrow. So I buy $50 worth of drugs on the dark market. You receive the $50. It gets put in escrow. And by the time escrow gets released, it's now $40. What's your reaction going to be? Ugh. Alternative, it goes up. Oh, crap, I spent $60 for this weed, not $50. So volatility really hurts for payments, and it especially hurts for payments when there's an escrow process involved. Silk Road was the only darknet market that I know of that was able to solve the problem. And that's because what they did is they had an optional arbitrage service where if you as a seller wanted protection against volatility, the Silk Road bot would sell the Bitcoin on Mt. Gox and then buy it back to transfer it to you when you actually cleared escrow. And so it turns out one of the biggest traders on Mt. Gox that wasn't a bot run by Karpeles was a bot run by Ross Ulbricht to protect his customers from the variations on Bitcoin price.
I didn't know about Silk Road's arbitrage bot. That's funny. That's actually kind of how the Lightning Network's implementation for remittances work, is it's selling and buying Bitcoin at both ends to deal with the volatility, because you're trying to transfer a certain amount in dollars.
Another classic example of how Bitcoin is a pain. That's just kind of like, and of course, Mt. Gox proved to be not the most reliable counterparty either. But so Silk Road did a wonder for Bitcoin, though, because Silk Road is what got Bitcoin on the map. Because before that time, you ask anybody what Bitcoin is, they'd go, huh? But the big expose on the Silk Road got a lot of attention going in. But even at the time, as I said, you never saw a huge amount of transactions because it turns out it's not the most reliable way to buy drugs. And you're depending on the mail, which means you often have records of who goes to where. And also, well, the marketplaces got taken down. Let's jump forward about a year to the fall of Ross Ulbricht. The FBI had a miracle. Lo, down from heaven comes the IP address of the server in Iceland that was running Silk Road. And lo, down from heaven, the FBI flies out to Silk Road, copies the server, comes home, and gets basically all the information they need to show that Ross Ulbricht was the Dread Pirate Roberts. So they then go into San Francisco, and when Ross Ulbricht is logged into the Silk Road administration console on his computer in the public library, chatting with an undercover agent who's playing a Silk Road admin on said undercover console, there was a fight in the library just behind him. He turns around, and the FBI tackles him with the forensics toolkit. There are literal screenshots where the FBI took cell phone photos of that laptop open on the Silk Road admin interface, logged in as Dread Pirate Roberts in the live chat, just to have that record. And then they found out that Ross Ulbricht made the Stringer Bell mistake. Stringer Bell's maxim, don't take notes on a criminal conspiracy. He took notes. Oh boy, did he take notes. It was literally, hey, prosecutors, here's how you prove who I am. And so the evidence was just huge. Things like there was a sheet in Ross Ulbricht's trash discussing notes on how to improve the Silk Road rating system and the phone number of his most recent date. And so the feds called the date just to be able to authenticate the phone number. But here's a question. How did that miracle occur? You could guess.
I remember the official story was that it was a misconfiguration that ended up leaking the IP address related to, I want to say it was like the image server or something.
Yes. And guess what? That was a lie. It was the FBI got caught lying about how they discovered the server. In the evidence is a nice set of server logs that showed that that was not what they saw on the net. They did not see the CAPTCHA on the net. The CAPTCHA does not leak on the net. I confirmed with a colleague who was crawling Silk Road at the time that the CAPTCHA never left the net or never escaped onto the net, because if it did, he would have told the FBI, because he's a good little researcher. And there was a public-facing web service that was an admin console that if you Google for, there's 20,000 copies scattered over the internet. Now, the thing is at the time, there was no way to write a warrant saying, I want to hack a unknown service that's located who knows where in the world to find its IP address. And so they didn't get a warrant. They just went and hacked the server and found its IP address. And the defense caught them. So the defense in the court filings actually caught the FBI agent literally lying to the court in his testimony, in his written testimony. That head FBI agent, incidentally, never testified in the case because if he did, he would have gotten torn apart on the stand for previously lying to the court. So why is Ross Ulbricht in jail?
It's just because of the selling drugs and stuff on,
and they
on
got
the
his
internet,
computer.
Right?
It's because his attorney was a flippin' idiot. So you catch the FBI literally lying about how they found evidence like this. You get it suppressed. If you get the server suppressed, you get everything suppressed. Because there's this notion in court that evidence that follows on from the suppressed evidence gets suppressed unless the prosecutor can show, oh, we would have found it some other way. The problem is the prosecutor actually had the evidence showing that was not sufficient. So Ross Ulbricht's name actually popped up on the FBI's radar before they found the server because of one or two wacky little posts early on advertising Silk Road. That was not sufficient to get a warrant for his Gmail account, because if it was, they would have gotten him before they got the server. Therefore, there's actually evidence in court that the counterfactual of, oh, if we didn't get the server, we would have found Ross Ulbricht anyway, showing, yeah, you didn't have enough to get a warrant then, you wouldn't have ever been able to find him.
Why don't they bring this to court now? Why don't they try to get this done?
Because it's too late. On appeal, you can only bring up issues that you brought before. And so what happened in court is the defense goes, see this? FBI lied, suppressed the server, and then it suppresses everything. And then the prosecution goes, oh, wait a minute. You see, under Fourth Amendment law for suppressing stuff, you have to claim it as yours. You have to have some privacy interest. So what would have to happen is Ross Ulbricht would have to write a statement saying, yes, that is my server, Kay, thank you very much. AKA admit that he's the Dread Pirate Roberts. There's an asterisk on this admission if he did this. That admission only appears in court if he ever testifies. And he was never going to testify because he was sitting on the Dread Pirate Roberts stash of Bitcoin on his laptop. So why didn't the defense claim the server as being Ulbricht's? There's three possibilities. Ulbricht was insisted on, I'm going to testify, and the attorney wasn't able to convince him otherwise. Or what I think is most likely is that would be an admission in the court of public opinion. And the lawyer wanted to get paid because the lawyer, although he was milking Ross Ulbricht's mom for a huge amount, another large amount was just donations. There was a lot of donations paying for the defense. Hey, I donated my one Bitcoin after he was convicted just to pay off some debts. I don't think the lawyer wanted to affect the donation stream. But in any case, as soon as the judge basically, who literally did a written order that was handwritten, basically, dude, you sure about this? Are you sure you want to throw away the case right now? And the defense threw away the case. And that made the prosecution very, very amusing. Fast forward to opening arguments. Opening arguments, prosecution was, oh, this is Silk Road, blah, blah, blah. Defense opening arguments were amusing. First was, yeah, he may have started Silk Road, but he left, and then he came back. And that does you no good against all the conspiracy charges, because if you leave a conspiracy and come back to the conspiracy, you're responsible for crimes committed by the conspiracy in the meantime. And also, all that Bitcoin Ross Ulbricht had, because he was sitting on a multi-million dollar fortune back when Bitcoin was worth bleep all. He was just a good Bitcoin trader or miner or something. at the time, the prosecution didn't realize just how stupid this was. I did. I spent a half hour coding up some code and showed that 20% of the Bitcoin went directly from the Silk Road wallets to Ross Ulbricht's wallets, because we knew them because they were seized by the FBI. Here's 70% or so that's almost certainly from Silk Road to Ross Ulbricht, because it just goes through a couple little intermediate steps. And cold email prosecutors. Oh, you do realize this is total bull. You have the private wallet files, which means you have all the Bitcoin addresses ever used and can therefore trace all the old Bitcoin too. At which point the prosecution quickly got their own expert who did the analysis with the private wallet files that showed, hey, basically every Satoshi that Ross Ulbricht had came from Silk Road. And, this lovely little payment to this dude called Red and White, this came from Ross Ulbricht's personal stash. Because, you see, Ross Ulbricht was a libertarian. And there's this great libertarian ideal of self-help. So what do you do if somebody rips you off? Worse, what happens if somebody rips off your customers? So one of the early scams on Silk Road was this guy called Tony76 did a bunch of sales, got a good reputation. Oh, big 420 sale. Oh, my competition is going to disrupt it. So you're going to have to click the finalize early and not put the money through escrow. And of course, Tony76 took the money and ran. So good libertarian ideals is you should hire a hitman to take out Tony76. But then again, good libertarian ideals are if some idiot thinks you're a hitman, you might as well loot him for every penny you get and not actually do the hit. So Ross Ulbricht tried over the course of his career at Silk Road to have 6 people murdered, all of them catastrophically failed. There were 5 through Red and White that were brought up in the Silk Road trial. So they had the chat logs between DPR and Red and White. They had the Bitcoin being transferred to Red and White. And they had a stipulation in the trial that he proved incompetent. There's no evidence he actually got anybody killed, but he tried, and that made a difference for the drug kingpin charges. That trying to protect your criminal enterprise by having people assassinated does kind of lend credence to you being a drug kingpin. And so that was actually brought up in the trial. It's just not charged as a separate element because, well, he didn't actually succeed in killing anybody. The defense, though, was just shambolic. They at the last minute, tried to get 2 expert witnesses, one of which is the one I'd hire in New York to turn into a prosecution witness for computer forensics stuff. And the other was the Bitcoin hammer, Ananopoulos, or whatever his name was. One of the big Bitcoin guys in 2013 or so. Very famous for a photo of him licking a mining hammer. That was his first hit on Google Images at the time of the trial. And so basically what happened is by that point, the defense was lost. He was guilty on all charges and basically sentenced to life in prison plus 50 sort of thing, showing the travesty of the sentencing that we do. And I lay it at the fault of the attorney that what the attorney should have done is claim the server. When the motion to suppress fails because the FBI tries some blah, 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 if we didn't know where the warrant was, you plead guilty contingent that you are allowed to appeal the motion to suppress. And you plead out to 30 years. But that's not what happened.
Yeah, I agree. The end result of that is a travesty to justice. And it's nice to hear you speak to that. But let's get back to the point of this being that Bitcoin now has failed as a payments mechanism, at least. And even back then, as you were saying, it was volatile. But it sounds like the Silk Road arbitrage bot was able to fix that to some degree, right?
Yeah, the arbitrage bot could fix the volatility to some degree, but at a cost. This is now makes the market traceable. If you run a market you're going to have to do either one of two things. Either you're going to be eating the risk of Bitcoin's price jumping up and down. And if you're going to want to eat that risk, you're going to want to charge a lot more for it. Or you're going to have to go on a marketplace, and that's going to be traceable. And the other thing is Bitcoin by its nature is prosecution futures. There have been cases where like 5 years out, Mt. Gox data is used in prosecution of early Silk Road drug dealers because it can be. Bitcoin tumblers, there's a lot of Bitcoin tumblers out there. The biggest one, they arrested the guy behind Bitcoin Fog. A lot of the other ones have been arrested. And that innate traceability is actually a real pain for the bad guys because you can be anonymous now, but the feds get more information and you cease to be anonymous.
What are people relying on in these dark web marketplaces then if they're not using Bitcoin anymore? I mean, are they using Monero? Or are they using, you know...
Some are using Monero, which sucks even more than Bitcoin, or they're just using Bitcoin tumblers and hoping they don't get caught. I think the success against the tumblers and against the darknet market associated tumblers, like the Graham's Helix search engine and Tumblr service, the guy behind that was arrested a couple years back, that the feds have just basically made the darknet markets unusable because it's hard to find them. Monero is hard to trace, but it's very easy to go to the exchanges and say, who's buying Monero and transferring it away, and who's selling Monero, and go after them that way because, well, you don't want to hold on to this stuff. And so the net result is the payment system. This is the one case for payments, censorship-resistant payments. But it's hard, and that has acted as the bandwidth bottleneck for these guys.
It does seem really challenging to maintain anonymity indefinitely into the future on a public ledger where every single transaction is logged and known to every participant.
And worse, where you're located in the U.S. for shipping reasons. Where Bitcoin still works for criminal activity is ransomware, and that's not because the feds can't find out who the ransomware purveyors are. It's that you can't extradite somebody from the beaches of Sochi.
That makes sense. I mean, on that note, do you think the preferred currency of criminals would be U.S. dollars? And on that note, we had a chat with Rohan Gray on here, and he's keen on seeing some sort of CBDC that retains privacy for the users. And I don't hear much about that from anyone in terms of the hope that some sort of digital dollar will maintain the privacy that cash affords users. What are your thoughts about this, and what do you think is the future for the US dollar and for Bitcoin and stuff like that?
So Bitcoin has committed a crime against me personally. It has made somebody with Silicon Valley libertarian leanings believe in the stark fist of money laundering laws. Cash is anonymous, but cash requires physical proximity and mass. $5 million in cash is a couple of huge roller cases. It's going to be your weight allowance on an intercontinental flight, and you can't transfer it remotely. Privacy, if you want privacy, you get cash. But cash has these physical limits that limit the total amount of criminality that works because you just got to drag this stuff around. I don't see any electronic payment system that supports privacy at scale. And the reason why is because when you do, you get the ransomware problem. That the ransomware problem is specifically because we currently have an economically viable, not very good, but economically viable payment system where you can transfer $5 million to some rando in Russia. Any central bank digital currency is going to have anti-money laundering protections. It's not going to allow pseudonymous accounts because the pseudonymous accounts with public ledgers are still pseudonymous accounts. It's every account is a numbered Swiss account, that doesn't work. And even the notion of limiting it to, say, $500 accounts, that does you no good when you can spin up as many pseudonymous accounts as you want. So any viable electronic payment system that doesn't want to get overrun by criminality has to have strong notions of identity and lack of privacy, because otherwise we have the proof of what happens, and that's Colonial Pipeline and hospitals ransomware and stuff like that.
I have an aside thought that's going back a little bit and is unrelated to this, but I did not previously know about Silk Road's arbitrage bot that relied on Mt. Gox, but when you mentioned it, it flagged in my mind, because I remember at one point Ross's lawyers argued that the actual Dread Pirate Roberts was not Ross, but was Karpeles of Mt. Yep. Gox fame. And so that's an interesting claim now with the knowledge that they were like actively trading on Mt. Gox. Do you have any thoughts on the probable involvement of Karpeles in Silk Road?
I don't think he was involved at all. I think he just viewed it as good for business. And at the time, the feds weren't serious at all about money laundering regulations on Bitcoin exchanges. So he was like, yeah, whatever. People are buying Bitcoin. People are selling Bitcoin. It's all good for me. I'm going to keep, I can't actually run a system right, and my Bitcoin is draining out.
Yeah, it just always seemed like such a strange claim to make to me after Ross had been arrested with his laptop open and logged in. But I remember them trying to make it, and it was always just a curious little factoid to me.
Well, it's because basically the defense was throw everything at the wall and hope something sticks. Like, one of the things they tried to do and failed is there was the fifth hit that Ross Ulbricht attempted, and that was with a corrupt undercover DEA agent who was trying to blackmail Ross. It's also why he thought hits were less expensive, is because the feds for a fake hit don't charge nearly as much as a scammer for a fake hit. And said undercover agent was trying to blackmail Ross, going, I know who you are, you're Anath Ethvail. And the defense actually tried to get that chat introduced as evidence without the addition of, oh, ha, Ross going, oh, ha, 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 f- you. And without the notion that, oh, this was a corrupt DEA agent who was known to be corrupt and blackmailing Ross. So, hey, the defense was it was not an effective defense. But for those of us watching and reading the transcripts and with our popcorn machine up, it was an amusing defense.
Cass, do you have anything else?
The only other addition that I'd like to comment on is that it sounds like you're saying Bitcoin has failed because it's not, or that Bitcoin has failed as a payments mechanism because it's not been widely adopted for that use. But in reality, it hasn't completely failed, right? We're still saying that there's dark markets where they're using Bitcoin, where they're using Monero, where they're using cryptocurrencies. And as you said, yeah, like the primary way to utilize that effectively is as a ransomware hacker getting a payout in Russia or the Ukraine. But I guess I'm wondering, it sounds like it still is being used for payments sometimes.
Yes, but it's not being used very much and it hasn't gotten very big. It's like the quip of, you do know this poker game is crooked. Yeah, but it's the only game in town. There's no alternative available for the bad guys. So if you want to sell drugs online, it's cryptocurrency or nothing.
Yeah, its value is as the mechanism of last resort, right? When nothing else can work, then perhaps Bitcoin is the remaining choice.
And it's kind of telling that for all the talk of Bitcoin as payment system, the one case where you have a potential huge market, because let's face it, the drug market's pretty darn big. You have proven successful-ish business models. It still hasn't taken over. It's just so hard to use. It's volatile. It just...
On that note, I think, unless there's anything else you'd like to add, Nick, I think that'll probably do it.
Nope. Sounds good to me.
Okay, perfect. Well, it was wonderful to have you on. Thank you for discussing the sordid tales of Silk Road. It was a fun trip down memory lane there.
And please, Celsius, rename yourself PS&T. It's such a better traditional name for a Ponzi scheme.
And that's going to do it for season one of Crypto Critics Corner. First off, I want to thank all of our listeners, people who have reached out wanting to support us, and everyone willing to have a discussion instead of an argument. I appreciate you. Thanks again. Second of all, I want to thank my co-host, my rock, Mr. Bennett Tomlin. I never imagined doing a podcast would get almost 100,000 listens in less than a year. I never imagined that doing a podcast with one of my best friends would get 100,000 listens in less than a year, but it has. And I am lucky and happy to have the opportunity to work with you. Third, thanks to all our guests. We had an array of individuals, from people I never expected to speak with to people who shared incredibly personal business stories with us. It's amazing to get the chance to listen to you. Lastly, and I know this is a little personal, but just over a year ago, I lost my mom. And to say that I expected 2021 to be a show is a euphemism. I was wrong. I'm glad I was wrong and that there were many people around me to lift me up. I can thank my godmom, my girlfriend, my podcast co-host, my editor at Protoss, my best friends, and more. Don't know what I'd do without you, but everyone, I can't wait to see what 2022 brings. And as the old Chinese blessing and curse goes, may we all lead interesting lives. Happy New Year. And remember, stay skeptical, friends.